In this episode of Ex-Tumblr Girls, we're discussing some pretty serious mental health topics, but we want to preface with a note that we are not professionals, and everything we talk about comes from our own opinions, reading, and experiences on social media. If topics surrounding abuse and trauma are sensitive for you, please listen with caution. We love you, and thanks for listening.
Hello, and welcome to Ex-Tumblr Girls, a podcast hosted by two ex-Tumblr girls turned modern Tumblr women who, against all odds, have critical thinking skills. I'm your host, Tori.
I'm your host, Carly.
Let's talk about Tumblr.
Start every episode with I never know how to start.
Yeah. Hey.
We both have wine.
I was gonna say, have you seen that Tumblr post that's like, I have three words in my vocabulary: hi, slay, and so true.
Yeah. No, I really relate to that.
Exactly.
I almost said so true, but
I hate to be predictable.
Yeah. So how has your week been?
I had a busy week and then a slow weekend. I went to a concert on Wednesday. That was really fun. And then this weekend, I slept till noon every day. And
I love that for you.
Yeah. I read a whole book. Nice. Which I literally forgot about until today because I like binge read it in a day and a half and then just immediately threw it out of my memory.
Was it just not very memorable or was it good?
No, it was just, that was just my ADHD. It was a fantastic book. I loved it. It was Normal People by Sally Rooney. It has the Hulu show with Paul Mescal and Daisy. I don't know her last name. But I watched the show first, and it was, I gotta say, like, almost identical to the book. But the book was fantastic and really easy to read.
I think my mom has recommended it to me because her book club is reading it.
I feel like that's really intense book for your mom's taste.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really know anything about it. But my mom, like me, likes really intense books.
It's just, like, emotionally intense.
Yeah.
Like, not the actual, well, yeah, I don't know. It's a really good book. I think you would probably like it. And it's one of those books that's, like, popular on TikTok, but actually worth being popular, unlike Colleen Hoover's books. Sally Rooney actually deserves the hype. Yeah, like, completely.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think one day maybe we'll do an episode on, like, the worst books ever written, and be talking about My Year of Rest and Relaxation, because I have beef with that book.
That is such a great episode idea, because I know we continue saying we're going to talk about John Green books, but oh my god, do I hate An Abundance of Catherines.
Oh yeah. I think that's one of his only books that I actually never finished.
It's one of the only books I've never finished, period. I always power through to the end of a book, and I physically could not get myself to finish An Abundance of Catherines.
Well, I don't think it was very memorable because I don't remember a single plot detail except for that there were an abundance of Catherines.
Yeah, the title says it all. There's nothing else to be said. But a Tumblr era book that is getting its spotlight as of, I think the author posted this maybe today or yesterday, is Maggie Stiefvater's Shiver is being given a TV show.
I am so excited. I don't think it actually was very popular on Tumblr. Definitely not compared to The Raven Cycle, which is her
That's true.
I remember because I was trying to find content and there wasn't a lot.
Oh, really? I remember. Say, I thought it had like at least a little bit of a following, but it's hard to compare to the following of The Raven Cycle.
Yeah. I, at least when I read it, I also read it way before I read The Raven Cycle. Like, yeah. I read the Shiver series before. For those of you who don't know, it's a werewolf series. So,
hell yeah. You also just,
like, right up my alley.
You handed that off to me pretty soon after you read it. So I also read it way before I read The Raven Cycle.
Did you read the other ones or did you just
read I don't think the first one? I ever did. I think I only read Shiver.
I really like the second book, Linger.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see what the TV show is like. I don't remember a whole lot of the plot. I think I remember more of the plot than I do of the Raven Cycle's plot.
The Raven Cycle, so much happen.
Yeah.
I need to reread it bad. Yeah.
And I'll have to reread the Shiver series.
Same.
Just like to prepare for this show. I will be keeping like myself updated with the casting and the set photos. I'm so excited. It's going to replace The Last of Us maybe for a little bit until they start are filming again. But for me, what I have decided to fill my fandom brain with is Yellow Jackets, which came, the first season was out a while ago. I don't know exactly when. I think the second season is, I don't know if it came out all at once or if it's coming out weekly. Crazy shit. I am obsessed with it. It's like all I'm thinking about. Actually, last night I had terrible nightmares about it. It's definitely not a show for the faint of heart. It's really gory and disturbing at times. But I love that shit. I had to stop myself last night and watch a bunch of cat videos to like calm myself down because it was really hard to fall asleep after watching it last night.
Oh my god.
But I highly recommend. It has some amazingly written female characters. It's like a really women heavy cast, which, you know, I always love.
The only thing I know about Yellow Jackets is that Jasmine Savoy is in it. And the only reason I know that is because she's a friend of Binchtopia. They had her on an episode and she's a godly wife. So they read her name every episode.
Oh, do you know who she plays?
No.
Okay. I'll look it up later. But you should definitely watch it if you are ready. You definitely have to be ready.
Yeah, I don't know. I've been watching cheesy dramas. Yeah. My mommy and I just finished watching The Crown.
Well, you know, maybe one day you have to be emotionally ready because I am not. And I'm too far in now to go back.
We'll see. I'm going to have to watch it in like the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah, probably.
When I am not predetermined to be like upset and disturbed.
Yeah.
But you know what I saw that was like unexpected? Well, okay. I shouldn't say unexpectedly violent because I should have expected it and yet I did not. I saw Cocaine Bear this weekend.
Okay, I've seen so much about Cocaine Bear. I have no idea what it's about.
So it's a true crime, technically, that this guy or these guys were about to get caught for smuggling cocaine and they dropped all the cocaine off of a helicopter into a national forest in whatever state, I think Tennessee, and a bear got into the cocaine, ate the cocaine, and then went on like basically a murderous rampage.
Hence Cocaine Bear.
And it's become somewhat of like a folk story, like the Cocaine Bear. And the impression I had gotten from the like talk about it was that it was almost going to be a humorous take on it. Like it was going to be a little bit like Scary Movie, you know, almost like satirical. And in at times it was, but then other parts of it were like full shown absolute violence. And I was like a little bit taken aback because
was it rated R?
Yes.
Okay.
But like sometimes
maybe you should have expected it.
It would show like the CGI bear like wiggling her nose as she sniffed cocaine. But then sometimes she would like rip people's guts out.
Oh my god.
I don't know. It was a really strange combination of things. And my friend who I saw it with after the movie, she texted me and she was like, You know how Martin Scorsese said that Marvel movies are not movies, they're theme park rides? She said, that's how I feel about Cocaine Bear. I don't think it's fair to call it a movie.
Interesting. I I've never heard that quote, but it does make a lot of sense.
Cocaine Bear's top review on Letterboxd. This is like perfect for us. It says, do you think the bear has one of those Lana Del Rey spoon necklaces?
Oh my god. Somebody needs to make an edit of that.
Yeah, after the movie, Abby and I were both blogging about it because they reveal in the movie that the cocaine bear is a woman. A girl.
Slay.
And they hate to see a girl boss winning. They hate to see a girl really boss do. Ingesting several kilos of coke.
The fact that she survived it is a slay.
Yeah, if I'd have known about her sooner, she would have been on the girl boss bracket last week.
And she would have won.
And she would have. Cocaine Bear versus Katniss Everdeen.
It's not even a contest. It's my birthday tomorrow.
Yes!
So, you know, when you get older, birthdays are less exciting. But
older as in the big 2-3.
Yeah. I just mean not a child anymore where your parents get you a bunch of wrapped gifts. Like, yeah. I got a Venmo from my mom, which is very nice of her. I have done a lot of online shopping. I went out to dinner last night. I did all-you-can-eat sushi and felt very sick afterwards.
Okay,
not food poisoning sick, just full sick. And tomorrow, I'm going out to dinner again, because why not celebrate twice? And other than that, like, I've got classes, so I can't really celebrate too hard. But I will be celebrating, and that's why I have a glass of wine tonight.
Yes.
I mean, it's we do every week. Monday, but...
It's birthday week. My birthday week. Last year, your birthday was so fun. We went to that little dessert cafe.
Oh, yeah.
You had an espresso martini, which you hated.
I really hated it. And it's because I thought it was going to be warm because espresso was warm. I was really let down by that. the only other thing that I have been doing the past week is listening to Hozier's EP just on
repeat. Yes.
I know that it's going to be, like, all three of those songs are going to be in my Spotify Wrapped, because there's no way they aren't. You know the part of Spotify Wrapped where they say, like, the song that you listen to the most in one day? It's going to be Eat Your Young. There's, like, I've already listened to it maybe, I mean, today, at least 10 times, but throughout the week, it's been way more than that. Today has been a low day.
I listened to those three songs on loop the other day while I was doing my physical therapy. So I had those songs playing for like probably 15 minutes straight. But I just know that January is going to have wrecked my Spotify Wrapped. My top 10 songs are going to be Ethel Cain's Preacher's Daughter album. It's going to be like, you listened to House in Nebraska 14 times in one day.
Well, that's all right. I was really disappointed by my Spotify Wrapped last year, and I will not be telling anybody who my top one was because I'm embarrassed.
I don't remember.
I didn't post it anywhere. Yeah, I didn't tell anybody. And nobody will ever know.
Carly, would you say that Spotify Wrap reflected perhaps a trauma?
It may. And why do you ask?
I ask because I would like you possibly to define for us what trauma really means.
Oh. Well, I definitely don't have that all prepared for you.
Because this week's episode is totally not buzzwords the internet uses wrong.
No, it's totally not.
Just kidding, it is.
Yeah, if you couldn't tell. We both have picked a few words that get misused quite frequently on TikTok, Tumblr, Instagram, etc. Maybe TikTok is the biggest culprit.
I don't know. I think Twitter is pretty bad with buzzwords.
That's true. I didn't think about Twitter.
But neither of us are really on Twitter anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not really on TikTok. Really, the only social media app I frequently go on is Tumblr. And you know, that gave me quite enough content to go off of.
Mm-hmm.
But my first word is trauma. It's something that now is probably used more like in casual mentions. People just be like, you know, that's my trauma. I have trauma. And it's just kind of thrown around quite lightly.
Yeah, which is so weird.
It is really weird, especially when you think about kind of the history of the term and how recently it actually has been added to the DSM-4, I think.
Do tell.
I will, once I find it in my notes. So the idea of trauma as trauma. <Not trauma.
laughs> I have trauma.
Okay, I'm going to be calling it trauma from now on. We should keep this part in. The idea of trauma as psyche damage didn't emerge until the late 1880s. Before, it was only used in medical settings, like a physical trauma, like a medical trauma.
Yeah, makes sense.
So, yeah. And before all this, you know, it was referred to as hysteria, specifically in women, or shell shock, which is what it was used in veterans. Like, it really wasn't called PTSD or trauma for most of history. Okay, so it was added to the DSM-3 in 1980, post-traumatic stress disorder was. And then it kind of has morphed meanings since then. Now, like, psychiatrists and therapists have kind of expanded what trauma really means. CPTSD, which is complex PTSD, is something that wasn't even a term until, like, 2005.
You guys can't see, but I just made two thumbs up and pointed them at myself.
Another expansion of the term was terms such as cultural trauma, collective trauma, intergenerational trauma. Those kind of started coming onto the scene in like the 1990s. And this was like in connection to things like genocide, enslavement, systemic oppression, things that couldn't be described as like a one-time event, which is what post-traumatic stress disorder used to refer to.
That makes sense.
So the definition of trauma isn't exactly precise, and it's kind of gained some meaning over the years, but generally it's an emotional response to a terrible event or time in your life, like an accident, sexual assault, or in terms of complex PTSD, something that happens over a long period of time. And now, like, at the dawn of the internet, which is when complex PTSD started being talked about, like 2005-ish, now it's kind of been used more universally just for really any kind of upsetting experience.
Yeah.
And I really don't know how to feel about it because I get it. Like, I get that we've all basically have trauma. We've all experienced suffering where we have felt powerless. And a lot of times that suffering stays with us. Mm-hmm. And whether or not we call it trauma, I don't really know if it's a big deal. I think where it starts to get a little bit problematic is when it gets really watered down. And now it's kind of like people can't talk about the more unattractive parts of PTSD, and it's turned into just like a fun thing. Oh, we all have trauma and it doesn't really affect me that much, when a lot of people with trauma, it does affect them quite like universally throughout their entire lives.
Yeah,
and that's something that, you know, we should talk about too.
Yeah, I mean, I was diagnosed with PTSD when I was 18 because of an accident, and like, I remember thinking like, oh, like, I remember thinking like, oh, I don't have PTSD. Like, it's just a bad thing that happened. They were like, yeah, that was a traumatic event and it's caused you nightmares. It's caused you panic attacks. Like, it has caused you stress to a disordered degree. And I was like, oh, like, Mm-hmm. I could finally understand that that diagnosis wasn't just for like the most horrible of the horrible things that happened in the world. It was like anything mm-hmm. that was a traumatizing event or time period that causes you prolonged stress, that's when it becomes mm-hmm. disordered. So mm-hmm. I think like you're right, trauma does get thrown around kind of just like for anything upsetting, but then I think people don't know the difference sometimes between having like experienced something traumatic or having like an instance of trauma and then having a trauma disorder.
Yeah. And I think we can have trauma without having PTSD.
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
I'm not going to go into the specific symptoms of PTSD, but really any mental illness is kind of defined by how much it affects you in your day-to-day life. This mm-hmm. is the same thing with depression and anxiety. Everybody has anxiety sometimes, you know, anxious thoughts.
Yeah.
And everybody feels nervous. But if those start to interfere with your daily life, that's when, you know, that is a mental illness. And that's kind of yeah. been how PTSD and trauma has started to be talked about. It's kind of been romanticized in the same way that anxiety and depression have.
Yeah, it's so strange.
It is really strange. I was, you know, looking on Instagram, just like I just typed in trauma and just tried to see what came up.
How many colorful infographics with bold new fonts did you see?
Oh, maybe it was 90% of what I saw. and I really, you know, I want to tell everybody, you know, I love an infographic. I'm a designer. I get it. I think that in terms of mental health discussions, maybe don't go to Instagram. Maybe go to a professional, or if you don't have access to that, you know, a reputable medical site.
Yeah.
Like Psychology Today, because Instagram is not the place. What I saw, the most surprising thing that I saw was a lot of influencers posing with like The Body Keeps the Score, which is a book that I'm reading right now. It's a very long process. And that's just kind of a good symbol of how it's been kind of morphed into this a thing that influencers can talk about, but, you know, not actually any of the negative side effects of trauma. It's just kind of a prop.
Yeah, it's been commodified, dare I say, into like yeah. a thing that you can make into content of like, this is yeah. my trauma. It fits in this neat little defined box of trauma. And now I can do yeah. this with it. I can do this about it. I manage it in this way. And it's like, I am never going to discount what is traumatic to one person or not traumatic to another person. But like the actual side effects of PTSD are like so gruesome. Yeah. And like I could never in my life make content about, I would never feel okay enough to do that. And like absolutely props to anyone who has managed their feelings well enough to be able to talk about them so vocally and like with so much courage. But like the experiences I've had because of PTSD, I could never voice online.
Yeah. And I mean, I've also experienced trauma and it's something that I'm still trying to define. And when I see people online talk about it so confidently and mm-hmm. succinctly, and they're just like, yeah, of course I have trauma. It is kind of hard to compare yourself to that. And a big part of social media is comparison.
Of course.
And I think that's something that was another part of the words kind of changing. That makes me feel a little iffy about it. Just, you know, having, I think that really talking to a professional is something that you can't really match with like any other resource. Like, I just don't think that there's anything that compares to therapy. And yeah. I think that when I see people talk about it online, it seems like it's kind of a replacement for therapy. And that's kind of where I get a little bit angry, I would say, about how it's used now.
Yeah, Carly sent me this absolutely horrific TikTok of this guy making like puppy dog eyes upwards at the camera. Like his head was tilted down a little bit. And he was like, here's the trauma test. Only take this if you're ready to know if you have trauma. have you ever felt hurt? You have trauma. And I was like, wow, what an absolutely non-nuanced take. If you have a license, it needs to be revoked immediately.
I did look into him, and he definitely does not have a license. He's like a life coach or something.
Oh, of course he is.
Yes. And I see on a lot of like TikToks like that, or people being like, you know, this is how trauma affects me, or this is how trauma could affect you. And everybody in the comments is like, oh my God, do I have PTSD? Do I have PTSD? And it's like, why are you asking this random TikTok girl that's just trying to get engagement? Like, TikTok is really not the place to be to get any sort of mental health advice. And I think that's something we'll probably reiterate throughout this episode.
Yes.
We are talking about a lot of mental health terms.
Yes.
And I don't think it's a coincidence that those are the ones that are getting watered down and kind of morphing their meanings.
And like, in all that, it's obviously not right that mental health resources are incredibly hard to access. Like, the class disparity of it all is obviously like a huge issue, at least in America, where healthcare is privatized and disgusting. It's not right that people should have to turn to social media to try to get a diagnosis or to understand what's going on. But it definitely has become a completely unreliable resource.
Yes. That's all I have on trauma. I'm going to have more trauma terms coming up. But Tori, what word are you going to be dissecting?
I'm going to talk to you and our listeners about the word love bomb.
Do tell.
Have you heard the word love bomb used online?
I have. I also have heard it in like, I think maybe I was first introduced it in an Instagram infographic. I want to say like the cycles of abuse, you know, in pink and purple with all these flowers and hearts in a bubbly font. It's always how it goes.
Yeah, it's so true. Well, just like trauma, love bombing is actually a very serious word. Mm-hmm. And I was able to find actually a ton of really interesting information on it. And luckily from a source that the references button had like a lot of nice peer-reviewed academic sources. Mm-hmm. So I feel really confident about finding correct information on this. But love bombing, much like the word trauma, is only kind of a recent development linguistically for a thing that has existed. So the phrase love bombing first came up around the 1970s and 80s and was used by quote unquote religious movements, cults. And it's first written about in 1996 in a book called Cults in Our Midst by Margaret Singer. And she writes that love bombing is a coordinated effort, usually under the direction of leadership, that involves long-term members flooding recruits and new members with flattery, verbal seduction, affectionate but not usually sexual touching, and lots of attention to their every remark. So it's essentially a tactic to get someone to trust you and submit the way that you would in a cult. But the definition of love bombing has really expanded to also include experiences in one-to-one relationships. So not just groups where it's a coordinated effort with essentially a game plan of how to brainwash someone, though brainwash was a related search when you look up love bombing, which is to speak to how serious it actually is.
Yeah.
But in interpersonal relationships, love bombing is a form of manipulation in which someone showers another person with excessive affection, attention, and praise to control or exploit them. And I think that is the piece that gets missed from a lot of today's conversations that use the word love bomb, is that there is an end goal to it, whether it is conscious or subconscious by the love bomber. It is for control and exploitation. I also found it interesting that this is literally from Wikipedia, but it has a source, so I'm going to use it. Psychologist Dale Archer defines the phases of love bombing
with the acronym IDD, intense idealization, devaluation, and discard.
Okay, so love bombing itself has multiple stages.
Yes, and I think that is a really good way to identify what on social media that's being identified as love bombing is or actually is not. So essentially, the process of love bombing in intense idealization is when the person or group showers the recipient with positive talk. So, you know, like, you're the most amazing person I've ever met. Like, I can't believe I met you. You're just so great. Like, I never thought I would meet someone as amazing as you. And some of the, like, other core things beyond just positive talk, because I think a lot of people associate love bombing just with the positive talk, but it's actually very multifaceted, is that they use the positive talk to kind of like get things started, right? To get you to feel good about where the relationship is at. And then one of the next steps is that they seek to make the relationship committed and defined very quickly. So if it's a romantic situationship, they want to be committed as your partner as fast as humanly possible, because they want there to be a clear definition of what you are to each other, because one of the facets of love bombing is a sense of ownership over the other person, essentially like their emotions. And what will happen is, one source I was reading says, the love bomber taps into your internal reward system to gain a strong emotional bond and ultimately make the partner feel dependent on them. So the person who is being love bombed is essentially convinced that this person is only doing these things out of the good of their heart. They only because they love them. And you're supposed to feel worthy of these things thanks to the love bomber. But then what they do next is, as soon as the person being love bombed does something to upset them, they withdraw. They immediately pull all of it away. And then they turn it on the person who's being love bombed. And they're like, why are you doing this to me? I love you so much. Or if that person has a strong relationship with someone else, they're like, oh, I thought I was the love of your life. I thought I was your soulmate. And then they'll attempt to get you to disconnect from other relationships and isolate you so that you're fully dependent on them, because they have showered you with so much love and affection that your brain has essentially been convinced you don't need anyone else, which is exactly what they want. And a lot of this is to say that this isn't always intentional. It's not necessarily a plan like it is with cults. In fact, a lot of times it's completely unintentional. It's subconscious because, like a phrase you mentioned earlier, it's part of a cycle of abuse. So love bombing, while not 100% caused by, but often very tightly correlated with, is it often comes from people who are narcissists. And I didn't really have time to get into like the clinical definition of narcissism, because it's quite like complex. But people become narcissists like psychologically, usually from trauma in their own life. From what I read, mostly like parental trauma causes narcissism later in life. And people who are narcissists will often do this to other people because they need to feel a sense of control. And they need to feel that this other person needs them and that they are the like full controller of the relationship. And when things aren't going their way, that's when they withdraw and then devalue and discard, which leaves the person who has been love bombed with a ton of trauma.
Interesting. I didn't know that it was that complex. I just thought that love bombing was just one part of abuse.
Right.
I didn't realize that it was like a whole cycle of abuse, like in and of itself.
Yeah. So I think that is like really the common conception of love bombing, is that it's like a one-time act, or like that it's just one thing, that it doesn't have like essentially outcomes or like responses to it. Like that the relationship doesn't go on after the love bombing has happened, but the love bombing has consequences. So some things that are like actually love bombing are often related to the time frame in which they happen. So you know, if you've been in a relationship with someone for 5 years and they're saying, I can't wait to have kids with you, I only see my future with you, that's actually perfectly fucking normal. Someone should love you that much after 5 years. If someone is telling you 3 days after you met, like, I just know you're my future wife, that could be a red flag for love bombing.
Yeah.
And the healthy thing to do in a scenario like that is to be like, that's too serious, and apply a boundary. Love bombers will not respond well to boundaries. They will get really defensive. They will devalue. They will discard because they can't handle boundaries.
Yeah.
Some things I've seen online get called love bombing that, from my now understanding of love bombing and my own personal experience with love bombing, that I would say are not, is someone being nice to you when you first meet.
Yeah.
That is not love bombing. That's normal. Someone being nice to you on a dating app and then not messaging you back. That's not love bombing. That's normal. Giving someone this is one I saw on a TikTok. Giving someone attention when you want their attention. So like hitting someone up and being like, oh, I miss you. That's not love bombing. That is maybe a little bit manipulative, but it's not love bombing. It's not a bomb.
Yeah.
If you're just texting them one time for attention that one time.
Yeah. And you're saying like a abuse term so yes. lightly is it's just a very serious thing. And like, even though I didn't understand the full like depth of the term, I knew it wasn't something that you could just like throw around with people that you don't even have a relationship with.
Right. Like people will like get compliments from someone and be like, oh my God, they're love bombing me. No.
If maybe someone the word they're looking for is being overbearing.
Yes. Like I was literally just about to say, if someone's being over flattering, like maybe they just don't have good boundaries, or maybe their intention is to get you to commit to them really fast. Maybe it is possibly going to lead to love bombing, but the way to hopefully prevent it in some capacity is to have a really strong sense of boundaries for yourself. Because love bombers won't like that. And also, it's like, I think something that I was like seeing, I was like reading some stuff about it, and then I was like, let me see what I can find on TikTok. And I was happily surprised to see actually some pretty good and well-informed content about it on TikTok in comparison to like the large amount of unhealthy content you usually find on there. But it was saying that like, this is a reason that you shouldn't rush into relationships, and that like you should take things slow because it actually prevents you from creating a trauma-based relationship. And from, you know, like if someone is laying it on really thick after 2 dates, you can be like, I'm not comfortable with this.
Yeah.
And you can, like, while it might not have been love bombing, you can prevent yourself from getting into a potential situation. Not that it should ever be the victim's responsibility to get themselves out of something, but it's good to be able to identify things that could turn into abuse. But the flip side of that is, I think there's a really big problem with calling things love bombing that are not, in that it does not teach people how to create healthy boundaries. It teaches you how to run away from normal feelings, which is that like, I saw one thing, it was like, if they give you butterflies, you might be being love bombed. No. It's having a honeymoon phase is normal. Like really liking someone when you first develop a connection with them is actually perfectly normal. Giving each other compliments is perfectly normal. What is not normal is if you are feeling like you love them and you voice it. It's okay if you feel really strongly for someone. You just can't bombard them with that information 24/7 right off the bat, because that's not healthy.
I have a lot of notes about setting boundaries and how that seems like the actual solution to a lot of these terms that are being misused. It's just like,
genuinely,
actually that's just, you know, this could be solved by just setting a boundary, you know. When it is abusive, you know, setting boundaries won't work,
right?
But in these situations that are being over exaggerated, a lot of the times it's a way more simple solution than people are making it out to be, and they're just turning to these trauma terms that they think they understand, but they actually don't.
And like you said, like love bombing is literally a form of manipulative emotional abuse. And so I really don't think we should toss that term around lightly to being when someone is nice and then mean. It's yeah. not the same thing. There's already words for that.
Yeah.
Take it from someone who has firsthand experienced love bombing. It's really scary. And you go yeah. through like some depersonalization while it's happening. And if we don't use it right, if we only use it to like when you feel slighted by someone, it makes it harder to identify when someone is actually being abused and, you yeah. know, give them the tools to possibly liberate themselves from that situation, which I hope is possible for everyone who is stuck in an abusive relationship. I really want everyone to be able to have the tools, but in order to have the tools, you have to be able to recognize it. And if you're yeah. hearing on TikTok that love bombing is just when someone's nice to you, you might not even be able to understand your actual abusive situation as that same thing because it seems too extreme.
Yeah. yeah.
So that's that on my piece on love bombing.
Well, good job.
Thanks.
That is a loaded term, and I did not know all of that.
I know. I like the more I read about it, I was like, okay, I know what this means because it's happened to me. But like the more I read about it, I was like, oh, this is somehow more sinister when spelled out like this. And when you identify yeah. like all the different steps that they took, it's very scary.
Yeah. And I think that's just like the nature of the internet is like we're not going to want to read, you know,
right.
paragraphs and paragraphs and all these articles and find all these sources when you can get it in a 30-second video on TikTok. And it makes sense that that's kind of what, you know, young people are using as their sources. It's just not right.
Yeah.
So the next couple phrases that I'll be going into are other trauma-related phrases, specifically trauma response, trauma bond, and trauma dump. So all of these words really have become mangled on the internet, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, I think it is such that they have almost lost all meaning entirely.
Yeah. So trauma response is usually, like, in terms of the actual definition, it is usually referred to as flight, and freeze response. That's like mm-hmm. the basics. Mm-hmm. of a trauma response. And as you know, the phrase suggests, it's a response to trauma. But actually it's like way more nuanced than that. And really what you see on TikTok is like, these can be a trauma response. And it's like people pleasing. You have a problem with scrolling, which newsflash, everybody does.
That's called social media addiction. Our whole generation has it.
Being a perfectionist, overachieve, like all of these things are not trauma responses, or at least not in and of themselves mean mm-hmm. you have trauma. You know, really anything can be a trauma response, but it's like I said before, once it starts to become a problem, you know, that's when we can start talking about it.
Yeah, they have to have a trauma that causes the response. Like if you're just a perfectionist, yeah. but there's no like reason in your life that caused that, that's just like your nature as a person, like that's not a trauma response. There's no yeah. there's nothing it's responding to.
Yeah, so like it is a result of trauma as a phrase being watered down.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I say like, you know, trauma response is a loaded term, it's really because there are so many different sorts of reactions that you can have to a trauma. And to be honest, none of them can be summed up in a TikTok. Absolutely none of them. Nope. Because for each person, they'll have a whole wide range of symptoms. And even fight, flight, and freeze is really simplified.
Yeah. When
that's not how the majority of people can describe their situation when they have trauma. It usually can't be like, oh yeah, well, I fought or I flute. what is the past sense of fly? Flew. I freezed. It usually can't be summed up in just one of those three words. And I yeah. get like the reason for the phrase, but actually the more recent term that people use, specifically to women experiencing trauma, is tend and befriend. Have you ever heard of that?
Ooh, yes, I have. I've also heard fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. Yes, so I'm assuming the fawn is similar to tend and befriend.
Yes. And the reason why, like, tend to befriend is maybe less common is because for the majority of psychiatric research, the main participants in these studies were white men. And usually they were, you know, veterans and had one specific form of trauma. And now we're starting to talk about trauma, you know, in a wider range of experiences. So naturally, the trauma responses will also be different.
And that's so true. I've never thought about that. That, like, those definitions come. I mean, I do think about the fact that the DSM is based off research of a very niche population that is not the only people impacted by mental illness. But I had never thought of the fact that, like, those three human instincts are also based only off how men responded to things in the 1980s.
Yeah. It's just so simplified. And I also want to say, like, these TikToks that are like, if you, you know, are a people pleaser, if you're a perfectionist, like, this could be a trauma response. It could be like, this could be a personality trait that affects you negatively. And that's completely valid. You can, you know, talk about that in therapy, but calling it a trauma response is just really unnecessary. Like, it doesn't need to be linked to trauma for it to be, like, a valid experience. Mm-hmm. And also, having a problem with scrolling is completely normal. Like, literally everybody has a problem with scrolling.
As you're saying all this, my brain just went, and the trauma is just being a woman.
Yeah. And that's a whole other conversation. Another trauma phrase that gets tossed around a lot is a trauma bond. And this one I have beef with because I really...
I also have beef with this.
What the actual definition is, an emotional attachment that an abused person feels towards their abuser, and it arises from the patterns of abuse. It is not bonding over trauma.
I was just explaining this to someone the other night, that sharing your experiences does not create a trauma bond. Having a power dynamic that is abusive creates a trauma bond.
Yes. And I think that there should be a word for bonding over trauma. I don't know. Maybe we can workshop some sort of phrase, because
it's literally just called bonding.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it's over.
And it really irks me because those are two, like, it's not even a slight, you know, change in definition. Those are two wildly different things.
Yeah.
And when it gets thrown around, you know, when people say, oh, you know, I have a trauma bond, and it's just like, okay, now I have to, like, dissect this post or video and really see if, like, what this is even referring to, because it just gets morphed into so many, you know, just two wildly different areas of conversation.
Right. It's like, did you and your friend talk about bad things that have happened to you early in your relationship, or do you have Stockholm syndrome? Please pick one.
Yeah. And, like, when I was looking into trauma bond, like, as a term, it really is just, it's just a more modern term for Stockholm syndrome. We don't really use that anymore.
Yeah. Except for the One Direction song.
So if you, you know, are having trouble, you know, wrapping your head around it, Stockholm syndrome and trauma bond are more similar than bonding and trauma bond.
Yeah.
I would say. I, you know, some of the TikToks I saw are like, oh, I still have feelings for my ex. Trauma bond. No.
Well,
not necessarily.
It's like, maybe if your ex was abusive, maybe. Then maybe.
Yeah.
But, like, just because they know bad things that happened to you doesn't mean that you have a trauma bond.
Yeah. And I think it's always going to be hard to tell based on, like, one TikTok. And the reality is when most people are scrolling through seeing these videos, they're not going to that person's profile to get the whole story.
Just like Binchtopia says, bitches hate nuance.
They do.
They really love a simple sentence that they don't have to think twice about.
Yeah. And I think that just, you know, if you just go on the internet, you'll see that trauma bond is one of those phrases that just people really don't know what it means.
Yeah.
And it's another, like, serious phrase that, like, we should not be using lightly. Another phrase, another trauma related phrase, trauma dump. Now, trauma dump is not really a psychiatric term. It's not really used in, because it isn't really an abusive tactic like love bombing is. Trauma dumping is just kind of something that the internet created.
Whoa. People are out here thinking that it's like the worst thing a person can do to you. And it's not even a real psychiatric term.
It isn't. It isn't. So what trauma dumping is when someone overshares traumatic events during inappropriate times, kind of without letting that person they're talking to engage or share their emotions. It's not the same as venting, you know. Venting is normal, you know, but a key part of the difference is boundaries.
Yeah.
Boundaries, boundaries, boundaries. It's really like, I mean, it's not simple to set boundaries. Trust me. Like, I get it. I have a problem with it too. But if somebody, if you feel somebody is venting too much and you can't get a word in, that might be, you know, trauma dumping, even though it's not really a hard and fast defined term. But it is something that, you know, can be avoided by setting boundaries, because it really isn't you. I mean, in my experience, when I've had people kind of, you know, dump on me their trauma, or, you know, like just start talking and I feel a little overwhelmed, it's really as simple as saying, like, you know, I'm kind of uncomfortable, you know, talking about this right now, or like, maybe can we pause? Like, I'm not ready to talk about this. Like, it's kind of simple. And I think that trauma dumping is just one of those phrases that people use to really like discredit other people's emotions and like,
yeah,
kind of just stop them from talking about trauma at all.
That's so true. I see people being like, oh my God, he trauma dumped on me. And it's like, he told you that like a loved one died. Like, he was sharing that with you. He was being vulnerable with you. And don't read into the fact that I said he. Don't do that. Okay. It was a random pronoun choice. Like, but like, when someone tells you something in confidence and is vulnerable with you, that doesn't mean they're trauma dumping on you. And if that makes you uncomfortable that someone's sharing something vulnerable with you, maybe ask yourself why that is.
Yes. Or maybe, or it's something that is triggering and you know, you need to set that boundary that you don't want to talk about it.
Yes.
Boundaries, like boundaries.
I think if for every TikTok there was misusing a psychological term or a trauma term, and it was a video instead about how to set boundaries or some easy phrases to use to become more comfortable with setting boundaries with people in your life, everything would be so much better if we taught people useful, like communication skills instead of ways to compartmentalize bad feelings and like shove them away as fast as possible.
Yeah. And I also think because trauma has been watered down, now trauma dump doesn't seem as serious. When somebody actually has trauma that they want to talk to you about, you know, that takes a lot of courage most of the time.
Yeah.
That's something that is hard to talk about. And to, you know, boil it down to trauma dumping is kind of discrediting, you know, these really hard emotions to talk about. And it kind of is like guilt trippy too. Like, maybe we shouldn't be like shaming people for talking about negative emotions and
and it's,
you know,
like,
try to have emotionally intimate relationships.
And it's like, even if someone does do it at an inappropriate time, or like, you know, starts to kind of spiral while they're talking and you start to get uncomfortable and you don't feel prepared to set a boundary, that doesn't have to be the end of your relationship. Like, it could, if it's if it's really that bad and like that's your final line, like that's valid. But I think the internet is also teaching young people specifically that like, when someone quote unquote trauma dumps on you, that's the end. You have to cut that relationship off right then and there.
Yeah.
Because it's an unacceptable thing to do. Right. Like,
and it, because it's like, when I like found out that it wasn't even an abusive term, it just kind of is like, okay, well, now it really isn't as big of a deal as people are making it out to be. It's not this like evil manipulative thing that people are doing. A lot of the time it's just people, you know, maybe not getting social cues and, you know, wanting to talk about things that they can't talk about with, you know, anybody else. And that shouldn't be something that is like shamed.
Yeah, I think the phrase just feels icky when it's like there is inappropriate oversharing and you can just call it that. You don't have to call it trauma dumping and make it sound so sinister.
Yeah. And that's why I really don't like using it. Because like oversharing is pretty much the same thing. And I think it, you know, it can be inappropriate and it can be overwhelming. But is most of the time not an, like, what would be the end goal of doing that? Making somebody feel bad for them, I guess. But that's usually not what it's about.
Yeah, I think TikTok really is working against the cause of having healthy adult relationships with nuance and understanding.
Yeah, unfortunately. But yeah. Those are some extra trauma terms.
I'm going to come in with one that's actually sort of related to kind of unexpected sharing. Or you said something earlier now that I can't exactly remember what it was, that I was like, this is related to what I'm going to say. Because I'm going to talk about trigger warnings. Oh, you were talking about trauma responses. And a trauma response is often related to a trigger, something that triggers the trauma response. And online, you can have a trigger warning, which I think, personally, I think trigger warnings can actually only be positive, except when misused or misdefined. Because I do think there's some negative implications for the actual positive benefits of trigger warnings. So a trigger, much like Carly said with trauma responses, is a high-level response to a stimulation that triggers an involuntary emotion related to a stored trauma. So it's triggering something in you that is out of your control, that is typically a really high emotional response that can be hard to come down from, that can actually be re-traumatizing if experienced like unexpectedly enough. And much like trauma, it was only began to be used after World War I when they first developed a phrase for PTSD, is when they came up with the term trigger. And it used to be called war neuroses.
Interesting.
Which is like, I guess that was the male version of hysteria for the 1920s. But since people have started to say something is a trigger, it's expanded over the years from just PTSD triggers to anything that can trigger an emotional response, whether that be something violent, like something that would trigger a war flashback, even to something like content mentioning eating disorders or self-harm or abuse. All of those things can be triggering for someone who's experienced them firsthand. And I actually read this amazing article by, of all people, BuzzFeed from 2014 that was analyzing the history of the use of trigger warnings. And they have a really interesting history that tie perfectly into our podcast. So trigger warnings started popping up on the internet right when it began in the late 80s and mid 90s on feminist forums. That's where they began. So these forums were kind of the first online extension of like IRL support groups. So they were forums where people could talk about things like sexual assault and rape and other atrocities that women face in these private forums. But when you're reading content online, you don't always know what's about to be in the post that you're reading. And so some people started requesting that others put a note at the top of the post being like, this is going to mention this thing, so that people knew not to read if they couldn't handle it at that time. Whereas with something like a support group where you go in person, you know what's going to be discussed and you make the moderating decision for yourself before you go in whether or not you can handle it at that time. Which is still the case today, is that when you're in real life situations, you have to make the decisions of what situations you're comfortable in and which you're not, because like real time experiences don't have content warnings on them, because only content can have them.
Yeah. I remember when we were on Tumblr, like, trigger warnings and content warnings were just so widely used, and it really wasn't even a controversial topic. Like, people were so willing to add trigger warnings to anything, because back when Tumblr Savior and Xkit were a thing, they could be easily blocked.
Like
any tags could be. And I remember there were some, like, kind of out there tags that people had, and, you know, because it was kind of common to use them, it just kind of, it was just normal. And I think now it's definitely kind of changed a little bit.
It's actually perfectly apt that you bring up how popular it was on Tumblr, because Tumblr is one of the first places it became normalized. So after trigger warnings started showing up in these feminist forums in the 90s, they then started showing up in, of all places, fan fiction in the early 2000s on LiveJournal.
That's, you know, I should have expected that, I guess.
Because, I didn't, you know, at all.
Fan fiction, you know, some of them graphic need trigger warnings.
Well, so people on LiveJournal who were writing explicit fan fictions started being asked to add a trigger warning for things like rape plots or abuse plots, because they could be triggering for someone who didn't know that they were about to come up in the text. Mm-hmm. And then it subsequently became really popular on Tumblr, which is where those same fandom communities spurred after sites like LiveJournal and fanfic.net. And it became kind of customary, like Carly said, to add a trigger warning to something if it was going to involve really sensitive topics or graphic content or violent content. Those were the kind of things that were first being trigger warned. And after coming up in feminist forums, it started coming up in feminist, like, publications. And one thing I found really interesting in this article was that one person said that they worked at a feminist publication. They actually themselves did not really believe in using trigger warnings. They didn't really think that they were useful, but the readership was asking for them, so who were they to say no? And I was like, what a perfectly normal human response. What a normal ass thing to do is to be like, I don't really get it, but if it's going to hurt someone else, I might as well not do it. Like,
yeah, but that's way too much to ask for most of the population.
And that is a really normal way to handle someone saying, like, hey, can you put a trigger warning on this content? Now, they also did specify that their printed content often or never had them, because one of the, like, ethical practices of journalism would be to create a headline or a subheadline that makes it very clear that the article is going to have mentions of graphic content. Like, one of the examples they were saying, like, if the headline has the word horrible, violent, or terrible in it, you should know that there might be something triggering ahead, and make the decision for yourself whether or not you want to engage with that content. But of course, it devolved over time on Tumblr specifically, and people started asking for trigger warnings for absolutely everything. So, like Carly said, a trauma response is something that is linked to a trauma. A trigger triggers a trauma response. Something that upsets you in just, like, a normal way of, like, I don't like to see that, something that you find offensive that is not necessarily linked to, like, a traumatic reason something would be offensive, such as, like, colonization or, like, cultural appropriation or systemic racism. Like, those things can be triggering because they're traumatic to the people who experience them.
Yeah.
Something that you find offensive, like nudity in, like, a non-strong context, like partial nudity on Tumblr, which was quite commonplace, that doesn't necessarily trigger a high emotional response, but just, like, puts you off, is not necessarily needing a trigger warning. And likewise with things you just don't like, you don't actually need a trigger warning for I just don't like this thing, because it's not triggering an emotional response in you. If the emotional response is I don't like this, it's not, you don't need a trigger warning for that. You just need to be able to say I don't like this thing and scroll past it.
And I think because on Tumblr you could block anything. And it was, we were, I mean, I know that both of us love to tag. We had extensive tagging systems. And I think now blogging has kind of changed on the platform, and people are much more like individualistic about their blogs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's not as much of a community, so there's less need to really cater to like all of your followers. And what I've seen a lot of people doing is like, if you don't like my content, don't follow me. I'm not going to tag anything. I'm not going to like, you know, filter myself or filter my content in any way. You can just unfollow. And I mean, I'm sure there's a middle ground.
Yes.
And I think that some of the blogs, like, you know, they're coming from the right place. But I think that there are some trigger warnings that, you know, should always be used. I do think that some are maybe unnecessary or like really specific. And it's kind of like, at that point, you know, that's your own responsibility. If you really don't like, you know, specific things that aren't triggering to a wide variety of people, you know, that might be one thing that could be left out. But now it's definitely different than when we were on Tumblr. It was way more like accepted to be tagging pretty much all of your posts.
Well, right. And like, if I don't know why this is the example that my brain came up with, so please don't judge me for it. But if an Anon messaged you and like, could you trigger warning anything that mentions fruit? You would be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I had no idea fruit triggered you. I'll definitely tag trigger warning fruit from here on out.
That's and it's not like, even if I like got that far fetched.
If I got that message today, I'd be like, no.
Yeah. And like, also, like, I get like 4 notes on every post. Like, my activity feed is dead.
Barren.
So I'm like, are you even like for real right now? That's kind of would be my response. Like, I didn't think anybody actually saw my posts.
It's just like, there are super niche things like that where someone will ask every single blog they follow, can you not reblog this thing, or can you trigger warning this thing? And it's like, if that thing is just like an item that shows up in photography sometimes, like, unless it's actually like something widely known as insensitive or graphic, like, it's very hard to anticipate that someone else would have that as a trigger. And you can't possibly anticipate, like, anyone could be triggered by anything. But the real, like, and look, I really don't say any of this to be invalidating, but like, there are certain things that should always have trigger warnings for content, because you can't trigger warning real life other than saying, trigger warning, I'm about to say this thing, which doesn't actually help anyone because they can't run from the room. You can have content warnings, but you can really only anticipate content warnings being needed for graphic, violent, really upsetting and trauma triggering things. And so I think the issue of asking people to trigger warning everything kind of made the idea of trigger warning seem absurd to the general population of like, oh, it's just all these people who don't want to be responsible for avoiding content that they dislike. And I don't ever want to agree with stupid conservatives, but in that way, they were teensy, 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 tiny bit right, in that it is each of our jobs as a content consumer to know what content we want to avoid and to not follow blogs that post that kind of content, to mute that word from our dashboard. Like, but like, even with people who have very common triggers, for example, say like sexual violence, unfortunately, sometimes we encounter it, and it's then on us to try to manage that feeling. Even if we shouldn't have been confronted with that feeling, you have to be able to do something about it. Now, I say this as a place of a person who is not good at doing something about it. But when I see content about it, I try to just be like, I wish that it had a trigger warning on it, but it didn't. And like, if I'm reading fanfic, like, generally AO3 is really good about those kinds of tags. And I know immediately, like, I don't want to interact with this content. I'm just going to scroll right past it. On Tumblr, sometimes things come up untagged, and I just try to be like, oop, didn't like that. Scroll past it.
Really, scrolling past it and not engaging is a great tactic that everybody should utilize more often.
And, like, aside from something that's, like, violently triggering, that triggers, like, a physical, like, fight response, like me with Nico from Scam. like, generally you might forget about it, like, within the day. Yeah. as long as you don't interact. And I don't say any of this lacking the nuance of, I know it's not that easy for everything. I know there are certain things that you absolutely cannot control, how they make you feel, how long you feel that feeling. And for those kinds of things, I think they're usually the more widely known about things that people do now content warning things for. And I think it's great that, like, absolutely do not get me wrong, I think that, like, content, written content online should have trigger warnings if it's going to have something that is widely triggering. But yeah, if it's something incredibly niche, the writer can't know to trigger warning that thing. And I think as an audience member, like, even though I feel for you, I think it is a little absurd to expect people to have anticipated that and then try to, like, cancel someone for not anticipating a really unpredictable trigger warning need.
Yeah, and I think that it's a really small portion of
people
on the internet that do that. It's just they're the loudest and the most annoying.
Yeah, the reason this was fresh on the top of my mind was because I saw a post this week of fucking Harry Houdini in boxers, and it was like something about how he was like trying to prove it was not, it was real magic. I don't know. And someone messaged the blog and was like, you should trigger warning that for nudity. And they were like, it's Harry Houdini in boxers. Like, what about this is triggering to you?
Maybe magic?
Trigger warning magic.
You know, that reminds me of another word that we won't go in too, you know, too much because we don't have a whole lot of time. But tone policing is a word I did a little bit of looking into. And it kind of reminds me of what you're saying about, you know, trigger warnings and asking people to moderate their content. And I see that a lot, like people using tone policing as kind of like a similar go-to. And it's really? Like, well, I've seen it quite a bit on Tumblr over the past few months-ish.
Well, leave it to Tumblr to misuse a term that is actually like relates to something that is genuinely problematic.
Yeah. I've seen it. It's kind of like a buzzword that's used in place of like, don't criticize the way I'm talking. And that's kind of how people are using it. And, you know, it's a shame. Because,
like, I guess if you really bare bones it, like, you're sort of right, but you're not totally right contextually.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, tone policing is, I mean, I'll just say the definition now that I brought it up, but it's when the tone of an argument is criticized instead of its factual and logical content. And it's usually leveraged by someone with privilege against an oppressed group. And that's the part that people are missing.
Yes.
which is often the case. People are missing the greater context of, you know, what these terms should be used in.
And it's the same with all of these, is that people don't know what the original, and then, like, look, it's not wrong for words to change meaning over time to fit the cultural context, but things that have like a legit definition and like an experience that attaches to that definition being watered down into like an easily usable everyday term, like, does do some damage because now there is no longer a word for that actual lived experience.
Yeah. And yeah, like you said, it's really natural for words to change meaning. And we didn't get to, you know, obviously we didn't get to talk about every single word that's used wrongly on the internet, because that would be like a 10-hour long episode.
Yeah, for real.
And it's just, I really think that maybe the takeaway from this episode should be, you know, boundaries and healthy relationships are,
and
you know,
nuance.
Something that we should strive for, and nuance. some of the other words, you know, shout out to gaslight. We weren't going to go into that. I think gaslight has been talked about.
Yeah. If you want to hear a good podcast on gaslight and gatekeep, you should listen to Rehash, because they did a whole episode on the word gaslight and then a separate episode on the word gatekeep. And they were both really interesting.
Yeah. I really got to listen to Rehash. I've heard so much about it.
I think I also listened to a podcast recently. It wasn't Rehash. I forget who it was, on emotional labor. And boy, there is so many problems with how that one gets used.
Yeah. I know. Oh. I didn't know we were going to go into that one. That one's loaded.
Yeah, there was a Binchtopia episode that mentions it that's called I'm Actually at Capacity Right Now.
Oh my god, that text message, like, screenshot that went around, I think it was, like, around the pandemic.
Yeah, it was like, are you in a headspace to receive information that might hurt you? I love the one that says, I'm not reading all that, good for you, or sorry for your loss. That is not doing the emotional labor.
Oh my god, I'm getting angry now just thinking about it. Oh my god, we shouldn't normalize that.
Yeah. Some other faves of mine that, even though they don't technically have, like, hard set definitions, that I think just get misused anyway, are, like, self-care and toxic. People use anything for self-care. And people will be like, oh my god, he's so toxic. It'll be like, he asked you a question. Like, oh my god, she's so toxic. She literally was just nice to you. Like, she's not love bombing you.
You know, I can't separate toxic from the Britney Spears song. So that
one doesn't.
I think.
Oh, wait, never mind. I'm thinking the Britney Spears song also.
Whenever I hear toxic, the Just Dance.
Yes, that's what I was playing in my head.
Toxic, the nurse just plays in my head. We gotta do a Just Dance episode next.
Oh, so good. What else did we have on this list?
Ableist is one that gets me a lot. And that's very loaded and did not want to get into that.
Also.
Oh, yeah.
All terms that we should all think more carefully about before we use them.
Yeah. As much as we love the internet and love, you know, Tumblr, we are willing to, you know, dissect its flaws, its many, many flaws.
And everyone should do that with all the content they consume. I know it's tiring to be critical and have media literacy skills, but it's incredibly important that you take a step back from the content you are ingesting constantly. Because, like we've said the whole episode, having an addiction to scrolling is, like, the most normal thing in the world now. And you ingest so much content every day that you need to ask yourself, what am I learning from this? And is the thing I'm learning from this actually good for me? And does it actually make true? Rational sense? Is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary?
Oh my god. It reminds me of my second grade teacher.
Yeah, I want you all to ask yourself when you listen to ex-Tumblr girls, is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? Is it true? 75% probably. Is it kind? No, we're haters. Is it necessary? Yes, it is, because we love the sound of our own voices.
And that's on that.
And that's on that.
Okay. Thank you so much for listening. We are so excited to have you here and hope you tune in again next Thursday. In the meantime, you can follow us on social media. Our Instagram is @XTumblrGirlsPod. Our TikTok is @XTumblrGirls. And we, of course, have a Tumblr. You can find us there at xpodcastgirls.tumblr.com. And we kindly ask that if you're enjoying the pod, to give us a rate or review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It helps us connect with the rest of the world's ex-Tumblr girls. Come join, be our bestie, and we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.